Hello, I'm Professor Keith McNeil. I'm Chief Clinical Information Officer for Queensland Health. And I have a couple of other portfolios, Acting Deputy Director General for Prevention Division and Chief Medical Officer. But I think today is all about being Chief Clinical Information Officer.
It is. And Keith, thank you so much for finding the time to join us. I know you must be a very busy man.
I think we're all busy.
Keith, you are Queensland's first Chief Clinical Information Officer. What does your role involve and how's that changed during COVID?
The role of Chief Clinical Information Officer is really one side of a coin, which has got the technical side of things, the things that allow electrons to flow around the system, keep the computers turned on, etc., which Damien Green does effectively as CIO. And my side of the coin is to make sure that what we do from a technical sense makes a difference to clinicians on the ground. So it adds value to their day-to-day work wherever possible, as well as improving patient outcomes at the end of the day.
During COVID, Keith, did the role change?
Well, it has changed a little during COVID in that the focus has been on our response to the virus, the response to the disease, mm-hmm. And how we can use data and intelligence to nuance that response. So what can we do at a much more granular level in different areas and use that data to inform the way we respond, the way we socially distance, the way we change elective surgery, et cetera, figuring out what the trigger factors are, looking at modelling and all of that sort of thing. As well as doing all the day-to-day stuff and trying to keep the lights on with the other digital work that we do. A lot of work's still to be done to optimise the IEMR, for instance, and continuing to do that as well as doing the COVID-related work.
You mentioned data and how that's informed Queensland's response to COVID. Can you tell us a little more about that?
Absolutely. I mean, that's the forefront of what we've done is that we generate an enormous amount of data across the system, both COVID and non-COVID related, but really we're moving to a point where COVID is part of our day-to-day life now. So what the data analytics has done is enabled us to have, as I say, what I call a nuanced response. So we're able to better understand the impact of the virus on the health system, but on society in general, and get the balance in terms of our response. I mean, how much do we lock down? How much should we lock down? How much do we need to lock down? Which, of course, has its own downsides. But the upside being that we can control the spread of the virus and what's the right balance there and how do we do it without having to shut great swathes of the state down? Can we do it in smaller geographical constructs, for instance? What's the time frame we need to do that? And what are the lessons learned? What are we learning out of Europe and what are we learning out of Victoria, for instance, that can help aid us in articulating a more effective response? And we've certainly learned a lot about that.
So there's been a couple of key people involved in this, but was it in partnership with the whole of health system?
In partnership with the whole of the health system, but also increasingly with whole of government data. So we're using transport and main roads data about how people move. We're using cell tower data to see where people move to over what period of time. We're looking at economic data to see where people are spending, et cetera, which gives us zones of risk where we might want to put up clinics or target a specific intervention, and we're just getting that all together so that we've got that ability to be able to respond effectively over the coming year. A lot of the data that we've got coming in we haven't used before, so it's been really good to be able to bring that together. And of course, underpinning it all is what we call the clinical business intelligence framework, which is where we can bring those disparate data sets together and link them, which gives us a much greater degree of intelligence.
It's amazing how quickly you've pulled it all together and how it's been able to help so effectively in the response.
Well, COVID's been a big disruption, but out of all of that disruption comes some opportunities, and certainly the people's need for and want for data and intelligence has given us a real impetus to move forward what we've been doing over the last few years.
And aside from this data analytics, has digital health helped Queensland respond in other ways to COVID?
Yeah, it has. It has indeed. First of all, modelling has been really good. So it gives people confidence that they know what we can and can't do. You know, the early days of COVID were a bit scary given what was coming out of Europe. So we had to look at that worst case scenario. And we were able to give people some assurance that we were pretty well prepared, or that we could be pretty well prepared for what we thought was coming. And of course, in preparing for what was coming, we locked down really hard and we got control, so it didn't eventuate, which was great. We're using, for instance, the monitoring of sewage effluent to pick up where we might have asymptomatic cases. So as we gather intelligence on that, which is all based on data, then we might be able to have a much more nuanced approach to testing in populations, et cetera, know when we have to test and know when we don't have to test, which, of course, might save a whole lot of people turning up and queuing for fever clinics when, in actual fact, in certain geographical areas, there's probably no need. So as we get more data coming together, we can have a much better understanding of how we need to respond.
Heath, Queensland's response to coronavirus was both quick and effective. We saw lots of changes in practice and innovation in how we deliver care. What do you think are the key areas where digital technologies can continue to support positive changes in how care is delivered and improved patient outcomes after the pandemic?
Yes, that's a really good question. I think the quick and effective, to be effective, it had to be quick. That's one of the things we learned. And that was really good, and digital certainly helped us in that respect in terms of knowing where and when and how hard to hit this thing. And that particularly was borne out when the Wacol detention centre came to light. We were able to lock down the right areas really hard and got it under control really quickly. COVID also, in the early days, prompted us to look at different ways of providing care, and probably the one thing that really stood out was how much we embraced our ability to deliver care virtually, mm-hmm. through either over the telephone or through video conferencing, et cetera, et cetera. And so if you think of that as a digital technology of sorts, that's probably the biggest change that we saw, although it's not revolutionary or innovative because we're already doing it. Mm-hmm. In fact, as a jurisdiction, we were doing it probably more than anywhere else in Australia and more than anywhere in the world in many cases. But what we did was we put it on steroids and now have embedded that as a way of working moving forward. And that's actually leading to better patient outcomes because people are not having to travel unnecessarily, not only for day-to-day routine care where they're able to interface over a video conference or something, but also in the paediatric sense where we've now got a virtual intensive care service being run out of the children's. And so we're avoiding people having to be transferred unnecessarily when they've got more acute illness. We're able to manage them in closer to home, which is fantastic.
How does virtual ICU work?
Well, what you have, in fact, it's interesting. The virtual ICU we set up first in Queensland was at Royal Brisbane. Mm-hmm. And I was the CEO at Royal Brisbane. I worked with a guy called Rob Boots to set up a virtual ICU module into Bundaberg. Mm-hmm. And what it meant was, and the way the children's are doing it now, is that the ICU clinicians at the children's hospital will do a virtual ward round or do a virtual case presentation with the clinicians, Mount Isa, or even more remotely than that. So it's basically a face-to-face discussing a case either at the bedside with mobile technology or an ad hoc request for information and advice. So it can work in many ways depending on what the scenario is.
Keith, digital health and virtual health are two terms we hear a lot, sometimes used interchangeably. Can you explain what they mean and how they are different?
Well, they're becoming sort of redundant terms now because health has been based for a long time on digital technology, and more so now we're using the benefits of digital technology to deliver healthcare, which essentially means that we can get information back to the point of care delivery much more effectively. So every day across Queensland there would be hundreds if not thousands of interactions between a patient and a clinician, and each one of those interactions to work effectively needs to have the right resources available, and one of those resources is up-to-date intelligence. So if a clinician has got a high level, high quality, accurate information about the patient in front of them, they can make much better decisions, and by default the system will work much more effectively. And we can't do that without digital technology. So healthcare is digital healthcare and healthcare are becoming one and the same thing. If we want to deliver healthcare in the 21st century, we have to embrace the digital agenda and build the ecosystem that enables us to do that.
Keith, where do you hope digital health will be in Queensland in 2025?
Well, I'd be a brave man to predict anything in terms of digital health, given that if you think that the iPhone's, what, about 10 years old and look at where it's come, the rules about the change in digital technology and data, they're just mushroom. It's exponential growth. So what I would hope that we will see – no, what I won't say hope. What we will see is that we've got an ability to bring all the health data about an individual together – into one place, and we're able to showcase that data back to clinicians and to consumers so that they can see a really accurate longitudinal picture of their health journeys, and we're able to articulate outcomes from those health journeys. We're able to aggregate them at either geographical or disease-specific levels. We're able to benchmark. We're able to look at variation. We're able to do that in close to real time. So that's pretty much where we're going. Now, that will change the way we deliver care, will change the way we commission, where we apply resources, and it'll change the way we drive up the quality and safety agenda.
So with technology moving so quickly, how do you keep up with it?
Well, I rely on people to let me know. So I don't get involved in the technology so much. I mean, the technical experts do that. Damien and his team do that. I keep up with the way we can apply the technology and work with people to make it the most effective it can be in helping them deliver their care. That won't change. Whatever technology we have, we still have to apply it effectively. And there's a whole piece of work that goes around that adaptive change. Digital change, digital transformation in healthcare has been described as the mother of all adaptive changes. And I do that side of things in concert with Damien. So we work hand in hand or two sides of that coin. And that won't change regardless of the technology. So the technology comes, we evaluate it, we apply it, we use it. But it's getting it fit for purpose for people and getting people to use it effectively where the real challenge is.
Keith, before you came back to Queensland from the UK, you had a similar role, didn't you?
Yes, I was the NHS's first Chief Clinical Information Officer and Head of IT, although my budget there was slightly bigger and it was £4.8 billion. A slightly bigger gig there, but yes. The principle was the same.
Keith, before you moved into the digital health space, what was your clinical specialty?
So I used to run the heart and lung transplant unit at Prince Charles. So I'm a respiratory physician by background and I sub-specialised in heart and lung transplantation and pulmonary vascular disease.
I imagine your respiratory knowledge has been helpful during COVID.
Yeah, so I've dug up some of my respiratory knowledge.
You have, yes.
I was intensive care trained as well. So I having that background knowledge has been very helpful and certainly in attuning what we need to do in the digital side of things with what clinicians need on the ground.
Do you ever have that urge to go back onto the floor?
Curiously, the thing I miss most is getting up in the middle of the night coordinating transplants.
Oh, really?
But I won't say I have a great urge to do that. But I like what I do now. I'm close to the front line and I've been out of clinical medicine for a while now. I gave it up when I left Australia back in 2012. So no great urges at this point in time.
And I guess over those years there's been a lot of changes in how transplants happen.
Yeah, not really. Mm. They're pretty standard, but the transplant unit is in much better hands ever since I left it.
Okay, thank you very much for your time this morning. It's been really fascinating talking to you and all the best.
Thanks, Meg. Really appreciate your time.